Tape 63, Side 2, House Judiciary Full Committee, May 10, 1979, 1:30 p.m., Room 350, Hearing and Work Session on Senate Bills 210, 211, 218, and 220.
Oh, okay.
Bye-bye, small contractors.
Right.
What small contractors?
House Committee on the Judiciary will come to order. The clerk will note those members present. The balance are excused. First item on the agenda is the public hearing of Senate Bill 210.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have distributed to the members of the House Judiciary Committee a letter in response to Representative Mason's comments previously regarding how come the Support Enforcement Division was so involved in the domestic relations child support area. Rather than read that letter to you, I have distributed a copy to each of you. Written copies of the testimony on Senate Bill 210, which I have to offer, are being distributed right now, and I'll go through that. This bill amends or creates statutes in four different areas. The first area is contained in Section 2 of the bill and requires that wage withholding orders entered under 23777 and RS 23.783 should be served on employers in the manner provided for the service of summons. Currently, those statutes relating to wage assignment orders do not direct how the employer shall be served. The amendment in Section 1 merely codifies existing practice. The second area dealt with in this bill in Section 3 concerns the language of ORS 23777. This is the wage assignment or wage withholding provision. The language is slightly altered to clarify that if support enforcement fees are delinquent, a wage withholding order may be obtained. Other language containing dated references has been eliminated. There's really no substantive change in that section. The third area of concern contained in Section 4 deals with the ability of the Support Enforcement Division and the district attorneys to have support enforcement fees imposed and collected. The statute, when originally acted in 1975, contained an incorrect statutory reference, which is corrected in this bill in lines 39 and 40 of page 2. That was the way the bill was proposed. The Senate Judiciary Committee, while examining this statute, determined there were two other areas in the statute which needed changing. So instead of a simple housekeeping procedure to insert the correct statute, we got involved in quite a discussion. The first area that's been changed is that under the existing statute, the district attorney or SED are to be awarded those fees regardless of who prevails in an enforcement proceeding to enforce the support order. The Senate Judiciary Committee limited this right to fees to those situations where the obligee, whom the district attorney or SED represents, actually prevails in the enforcement proceeding. Thus, the scope of the number of cases where these fees can be awarded has been limited, and it does require that the obligee prevail in that particular proceeding. The second area of concern is the manner in which these fees are to be collected. The statute, as enacted in 1975, provided that 25% of each payment received by the county clerk or the Department of Human Resources would go towards the fee until the support enforcement fee was paid in full. The Senate Judiciary Committee did not approve of this existing procedure because they felt it took money from the children to pay for the costs incurred by the state in enforcing child support obligations. While the committee felt it was appropriate to charge for the cost of enforcement, it also wanted assurance that the children would not be severely impacted by the collection of the fees. Therefore, language was adopted requiring that when money is received, the amount of the monthly support obligation shall be paid to the appropriate obligee. In other words, whatever is due that month will be paid. Payments on the support enforcement fee shall be made out of the money received, which is in excess of the regular monthly support payment. So in other words, if you had a monthly support payment of $100 and $100 was received, the support services unit would forward $100 to the obligee. But if $120 was received and the support order was $100, $100 would be forwarded to the obligee and $20 would be used to pay the support enforcement fee. Such a diversion of money would continue until the support enforcement fee was paid in full.
How often do money beyond the amount of fee or money beyond the amount of support, is that a common occurrence?
Well, I think the statute was written and it is a common occurrence in one particular situation. If you have a wage withholding order under ORS 23.777, the employer is required to withhold 25% of the net disposable income of the employee, regardless of whatever the support order is. You can only get that order when there is a delinquency. Very often, the 25% of the net disposable income exceeds the amount of the support order. So when wages were withheld, additional money is received. Okay.
Representative Rutherford, do you think it would be fair that in the event that the obligee prevails in these matters, that he or she be awarded attorney fees?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the
if you take somebody to court to enforce an award, and for some reason they prevailed, for instance, your records were incorrect or whatever, including other reasons that they may prevail, do you think that they should be entitled to attorney's fees?
Should the obligor be entitled to attorney's fees? That's what threw me. No, I don't necessarily think that is so. The reason the obligor is being hauled into court in the first place, supposedly in an enforcement proceeding, is because there is a delinquency on the support payment.
And that was his question. There's an alleged delinquency.
There is an alleged delinquency on the payment, and if that delinquency is in fact proved, I think it's appropriate that support fees be awarded.
That's not the question. The
I
question
understand.
Is if you're wrong and there is no delinquency, then should the other people be able to get attorney's fees against you or the district attorney, whoever's bringing that person into court?
Not unless it's a malicious prosecution. You don't get an award of attorney's fees if the district attorney prosecutes you for manslaughter and, in fact, you aren't found guilty. This is not a crime per se, but it is a violation of a moral and legal obligation which is imposed by a court. I realize there's a degree of difference there, but you're attempting to enforce a court order, and, in fact, if there's a contempt proceeding, the pleadings are styled state ex rel. Because it is a contempt proceeding and you're enforcing an order of the court. You're not enforcing a private order, say a contract between two parties and there's been a judgment awarded. It's a little bit different type of proceeding.
Can you give me any other instance in the Oregon Revised Statute where one party can collect attorney's fees if they prevail and the other party, if they prevail, cannot?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay.
This is
so
the way
one side can receive them, doesn't equity really demand that if the other side prevails, that they should be able to receive them also?
That depends on how you analyze the question. If you analyze it in the context I gave, that you're enforcing a legal order of the court and it's somewhat akin to a criminal proceeding, I don't think it's necessarily true. But if you just, you know, it's obviously a policy decision for the committee. If you just want to waive the flat-out equities of somebody being taken to court and one party or the other is awarded the fee, then equity would dictate that both parties be able to get that fee. The statute currently provides that the obligee, I believe the statute reads, cannot get the fee unless he's represented by the court enforcement division or the district attorney, and thus it would tie in with the extensive child support enforcement system that's been created by state and federal statute.
If you had to make an election under this bill, either to delete the portion where you collect attorney fees or that attorney fees be awarded to the obligor where he or she prevails, which attorney would you prefer?
I'd let the obligor get attorney fees. The reasoning behind that is if the state is in fact wrong or for some reason or another the obligor does prevail and the state was in error in bringing that, they should be more careful in bringing that sort of action.
So then you do believe that if the state is in error in bringing an action, they should get attorney's fees? The obligor should get attorney's fees?
I didn't say I personally believe that. I'm saying that analysis could be adopted by the Judiciary Committee.
What's the position of your department?
The position of my department is that they like the existing statute, and what they all originally want to do is just correct the statutory reference. This was supposed to be a housekeeping bill, and it got much deeper than that.
So you'd rather have not pursue the bill then?
No, Representative Rutherford just asked if I had to make a choice of either not getting any fees whatsoever, which is the current situation because of the statutory error, or allowing the obligor to get attorney fees. I'd rather have the obligor get attorney fees because SED and the district attorney especially are going to collect fees in a large number of cases. I think in that letter that I addressed to the House Judiciary Committee, gave you some idea of the scope of the problem. Thousands and thousands of cases that are brought every year in court to either establish the court obligations or enforce them.
Okay, you want to continue?
Okay, thank you, Chuck. The way the Senate committee wrote the bill, the method of deduction that they provided has less impact upon the children. And in addition, if the collection of the fees caused undue financial hardship on the obligee, the district attorney or SED might remit all or part of the fee collected to the obligee. That's the way the bill is written. One final word on the support enforcement fees. They are not like private attorney's fees. They don't amount to $300 or $400 for enforcement action. Right now, the fee, if there is a court appearance and not over 2 hours of attorney time involved, amounts to $153. These fees are calculated to reimburse the Support Enforcement Division for the actual cost of support enforcement services in particular areas, and indeed, statute mandates that they be calculated in that manner. The district attorney and the Sport Enforcement Division are not given a blank check to charge fees. In other words, they can't set the fee at anything they want, for the fees must be charged in accordance with the fee schedule. And you, as the legislature, have a hand in setting that fee schedule, because by statute, although the attorney general establishes the schedule must be approved either by the Joint Ways and Means Committee, if the legislature is in session, or by the E-Board, if it is not in session. Thus, the legislature continues to have a hand in limiting the amount of fees charged. The final area of concern in this bill, dealt with in Section 6 and 7, is clarification of who is entitled to the support rights of the children in the custody of CSD, the Children's Services Division, when that division is required to provide financial assistance to those children. Section 6 deals with cases where the child is voluntarily placed in CSD custody, and Section 7 deals with cases where the court places children in CSD custody. The bill, as written, makes it clear that CSD is entitled to that child support right.
Question? Larry, I see in my bill folder there was a minority report. Did you talk? I'm just curious. I didn't even read it. What was the issue in the minority report?
I forget at this point. I believe that was carried by Senator Wires, and it had to do with how the fees are going to be deducted.
Okay.
The fees are going to be deducted. Frankly, I don't have the minority report with me. I forget the issue.
Any further questions for the witness?
Support enforcement is strictly has to do with child support.
The establishment of support obligations and paternity and enforcement.
Okay, so it can't extend them to alimony?
Support rights are assigned pursuant to state and federal statute, and all support rights are assigned, including alimony.
Okay, I've run into a couple of problems where these payments are coming to the state from out of state, and there's, I think, considerable deep misunderstanding by some of the parties involved. In my case, a young mother, as to why, when the money is received after a certain date, she did not get her full payment, but the state helped them out. Now, I'm sorry I walked in after you had begun, and I may have missed your explanation, but can you give me an idea why that would happen?
Okay.
We then called over and talked to somebody, and they released the whole thing because I gathered that there was some kind of an obligation to pay part of it for the, frankly, for your service.
Was this a case that was handled by the Support Enforcement Division or the District?
I don't know. No, it's Support Enforcement. It was CSD somewhere in Human Resources. I'm a little fuzzy about exactly what's your responsibility.
Right. There's a lot of variables involved. If it's a CSD case, the only party that's receiving assistance is the child. And so child support would be taken by the state up to the extent that the state is giving out assistance. But an alimony order would not be taken because, in fact, the mother of that child is not receiving public assistance. Only the child is receiving public assistance. If it was a welfare case, public assistance case, generally, the grant provides that the custodial parent, who is usually the mother and the children both, are receiving assistance. The needs of the mother are taken into account in calculating the amount of the grant. If that's the case, then the alimony rights are assigned to the state because, in fact, the state is paying support for that custodial parent.
I won't take the committee's time anymore, but I'd like to get a little better acquainted with your whole procedure and what kind of documents these people sign. This is a fairly young girl, and she indicated to me that she wasn't fully aware of what her responsibilities and what her responsibilities were under whatever she signed.
Right.
And we got the case resolved with a couple of phone calls, so I've never seen the basic document. I'd like to see one of those.
Okay.
Do you have a regular form? And
there is a regular Adult Family Services Division form containing an assignment.
Can you arrange to get me some, please? I'm not sure how wide.
That form was challenged in the Court of Appeals to the extent of the assignment, and that was Davis Hanson versus McKay, and it was held that the assignment was valid. I believe that all support rights were assigned to the state. If you could get me a copy of the form.
I would really appreciate it. And then give me a couple of references to the ORF that establishes these arrangements, and then whatever administrative rules you've got that you operate under.
Okay. The statute would be ORS 418042. That mandates an assignment of support rights.
418042?
042.
Sure. Along that same line, on page 3 of the bill, line 14, says including any sums which may have accrued, CSC would step into a position of being entitled to all sums owing with respect to the child, including accrued sums. Seems to me that that's par for the course. That's normal. Welfare also get the right to payments that have not been made in the past. And so I guess you can justify it on that basis. But if for some reason the parent had put out money in the past, and the mother put out money in the past, the father never paid, and then for whatever reason the child went over to CSD, and then the father comes in with the money and is in a position to pay, CSD would get a windfall, wouldn't it? And the former custodial parent would put out all her own money, would lose. She'd take a second position behind CSD, wouldn't she?
She would take a second position behind CSD, but CSD would not get a windfall because they would only be entitled to take that portion of the arrearage up to the amount of assistance that they had actually given to the
okay,
child.
Okay, is that in there? Maybe I missed that.
That's under federal regulation, essentially.
But it's not in the bill?
It's not in the bill, but federal regulation controls.
I wonder if it should be in the bill. That they would subrogated, become affine of and subrogated to any
where
right to support.
Where are you reading, please?
Page 3, line 13. Right to support from any other person, including all sums which may have accrued up to the amount of support actually paid by CFC, something like that.
I would have no problems with that sort of way.
Could, is the federal regulation, does it contain the language that I would need to plug in there? Or can we make something up afterwards? I want to make sure I get the words right.
Right. That's certainly exactly what language is contained in the federal regulation. I'm word for word, but the general intent of the regulation and the wording that is used make it applicable to the words you just used.
Well, I throw the question to the committee then, whether there's any interest in the point that I'm pursuing.
Yeah. I think we're getting it. My problem.
Okay.
Further questions, please? Mr. Mason, 222 is coming over now. What about the stepfather bill, too? Did that pass?
Senate Bill 147, providing for step-parent liability, was referred to the Senate Ways and Means Committee this morning by a fairly sizable margin.
Is that one of your bills, too?
No, that is that's a Department of Human Resources bill. It was tied by Senator Cook to Senate Bill 222, but Senate Bill 222 is merely an administrative procedure to establish support obligations. It doesn't create substantive duties of support. Senate Bill 147 does create substantive duties of support. And so you could use 222 to establish a support order based on 147, if 147 ever gets out of the Senate.
Further questions? Okay, is there anyone else? I'll ask at this time, before you leave, is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 210? Okay, why don't you just move to Senate Bill 211?
All right. Chairman, this bill is designed to reorder and expand existing statutory provisions relating to the transfer of court files between courts of different Oregon counties. The bill as written is designed to solve two existing problems. First problem is created when a court file is transferred from one county to another county for enforcement of a child support obligation. The problem is that the county where the original order is entered does not receive a copy of any orders entered in the other county. This bill provides that certified copies of all orders entered in the second county must be sent to the county where the order originated, and thus assures that the county where the order originated will have a complete record of all orders entered, regardless of how many counties to which the court file is transferred. At the request of Senator Cook, the bill was amended in committee to deal with a second problem relating to the transfer of files. That problem is that present law prohibits the transfer of court files for the purpose of modification of an order or decree unless there is a delinquency in the money payments ordered. The bill, as it now exists, would permit transfer of files between counties for the purpose of modification. The bill was substantially altered in the Senate committee, and when Jim McCandlish and I were drafting amendments, we neglected to omit lines 4 through 9 on page 1 of the A engrossed bill. That amendment to ORS 18.335 is not necessary, and so I suggest that the committee could delete that particular section of the bill.
Don't need it.
Now, as the bill was originally written, it had involved a somewhat more complex scheme. You would send the original orders to the county of origin, and that would have contravened 18.335. But the way the bill is written now, whatever county the order is entered in will have that particular order on file.
Questions to the witness? Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 211? If not, we move to Senate Bill 218.
You've got a fiscal impact statement, too. Sure, that's a lot.
Well, we're passing that. Could I ask a question?
Certainly.
I don't need to harp on attorney fees today. What's the situation with respect to modification orders? Does FED get attorney fees in the most
circumstances? Our practice, I don't know if they're authorized by statute. Our practice has been to not get attorney fees. If you're talking about support enforcement fees, FED does not get support enforcement fees right now because of the statutory reference.
I understand that, but I was thinking in modification cases, is that treated differently?
No, not by FED. I don't know the question of whether it could be treated under the statute differently, but it's been a policy that we, unwritten policy, that we don't ask for attorney's fees. When we bring a paternity case under the conciliation statutes in Chapter 109, we do ask for attorney's fees. It is provided by statute, and we do get awards for attorney's fees on a number of cases, primarily used as a bargaining point. And conversely, we get nicked occasionally when we lose a paternity case, too. So although you could argue that the obligee should pay the attorney's fees, in reality, the Department of Justice pays the attorney's fees, or ultimately, the Department of Human Resources pays it.
Okay. Senate Bill 218.
Before you start, Larry, let me save you a little bit of time. On page 1 of the bill, section 2, the amendment to ORS 14.035, that section is also... Actually, it's not amended, repealed by the Civil Procedures Bill. This is a question of the long-arm statute and the jurisdictional nexus in paternity cases. And so if you assume that the Civil Procedures rules are going to pass, then you could cut that part out of the bill.
Section 2 of the bill?
Section 2 of the bill.
Well, that's, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's quite accurate as the way the bill's written, because Section 2 does... amend the long-arm statute. Section 7 of this bill says no matter what the court, the Council on Court Procedures does, it doesn't affect this amendment.
That was
at the request, again, of Senator Cook and the Judiciary Committee. I did meet with Fred Merrill on this particular matter, and it's my understanding that he is drafting the rules that the Council will submit to you on the revised procedures in language substantially similar to this bill, so the problem will be taken care of one way or the other.
Well, I just raised it. Then you can go ahead, but I raised this issue. Bruce Hamlin called me today and said that Section 2 conflicts with the rules as introduced on Monday. I'll check it out.
What's the other law on minimum contact in regard to sexual intercourse? You quote state Dr. Al McKenna versus Bennett, but I seem to remember there's been other courts and other jurisdictions that held different on this particular point, that sexual intercourse has not been held to be it can be the basis for a tort. I think it's a tort. Somebody tried to put forth the idea that tort a wrongful pregnancy.
Well,
and that
well,
was.
Okay. You say you think there's sufficient nexus, is that right?
Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's a maximum contact.
That was the case of McKenna versus Bennett. The Pendleton SED office brought a paternity proceeding where the Albagor lived right across the Columbia River in Washington, and he came over one night and got a lady pregnant in Oregon, and then refused to come back across the state line. We couldn't serve him, so they served him based upon a long-arm theory and stated that a tort theory under the statute. And in fact, paternity was established because he defaulted, and a support order was entered. And then when we went to enforce the support order, we suddenly got his attention and came back in and had the paternity order set aside. And the Court of Appeals on appeal held that the statute, the long-arm statute in Oregon, did not provide that sexual intercourse was a minimum contact. There was nothing wrong constitutionally. Constitutionally, sexual intercourse is a minimum contact. It's just
well,
that the statute didn't authorize.
You mean they found no statutory basis, yet they went to the constitutional question?
It was dicta.
That's my point. It wasn't dicta. They never really resolved it on it, then, did they?
Well, they quoted a case on page 1283 of the case. The birth of a child in Oregon for whom the parent would have a legal obligation of support is a foreseeable consequence of an act of sexual intercourse in Oregon. Therefore, there is sufficient connection with Oregon for the legislature to constitutionally provide for long-arm jurisdiction in such a situation, citing Becora versus Balkan, an Arizona appellate case.
Did you have a question,
sir?
No.
Maybe I'm not.
Is this joke circulating the way?
I think
yeah.
I remember it well.
I've been trying to avoid it. I just passed it on.
Dennis?
And then it so
I'm going to
check
it here, though.
You don't want it.
Maybe I shouldn't push it, but I want to push it anyway. The bill that we just introduced, this big one on civil procedures, repealed 14.035. And I think that this bill that we have in front of us probably came over before we were finished with it. I think it's more appropriate to delete Section 2 of this bill and to delete Section 7 of this bill because the language of Section 2 is exactly the same as the language in this bill, and I think it'd be...
We discussed this bill when we were doing the rules.
Yeah, so I think that maybe Senator Cook had a point that he wanted to have made back several months ago when he dealt with it, but I think at this point that point's been resolved.
Well...
Mr. Chairman, when I dealt with Mr. Merrill, we tried to make the two things exactly similar. I didn't know exactly what he finally ended up with. If in fact, the language is exactly the same, I wouldn't object to deleting Section 2 and 7.
Okay, let's go through the rest of the bill.
Okay. The bill addresses five separate areas involved in the establishment of paternity of a child. Section 1 of the bill amends ORS 12.160 to extend the disability provisions regarding time to file a lawsuit to paternity suits. A similar time extension is already given to minors in other types of lawsuits. The basic effect of the change would be to allow a minor to bring a paternity suit for an additional 5 years. I'll skip Section 2 because I assume that the committee is going to delete that. Section 4 of the bill changes the definition of a child born out of wedlock to include kids born in wedlock but fathered by someone other than the husband. In the case of F versus H, that citation is slightly incorrect, an Oregon appellate case, the Court of Appeals held that the phrase child born out of wedlock, which is contained in the filiation statutes, did include a child born in wedlock but fathered by someone other than the legal husband. The Supreme Court reversed that case in Fox versus Hellenshell. It was actually the same case, just slightly different name. By changing the definition, the statutory scheme for the establishment of paternity may be used instead of using a declaratory judgment process. Right now, if a child is born in wedlock, you have to file a suit for declaratory judgment, even if the father is not the husband. And by simply adopting this particular change, then we'd be able to file a paternity petition under Chapter 109 and all of that, all of the associated baggage that goes with a paternity suit, and the rights and remedies involved therein would follow.
So we're only dealing with those cases where there would be a rebuttable presumption.
Yeah.
Where there's no cohabitation.
Right.
Okay. Let me just get this straight. You're talking about the case where the husband is not living or cohabiting with the wife, is that it, and you're attempting to establish paternity?
Yes. We get a number of cases where, say, the husband is in prison or the husband moved out of state 6 years ago or something like that, and a child is born. Well, the child is born in wedlock because no divorce was ever obtained, but the father is not the husband. The state bears the burden of going in and beating that rebuttable presumption, proving that, in fact, the husband is not the father. That's really not involved in this. All this is what manner or what way is the state going to be going in? Is it going to be going in under Chapter 109, or is it going to be going in as a suit for declaratory judgment? The way the paternity statutes are interpreted right now, no matter which way you attempt to establish paternity, whether it be by a reciprocal support order or affiliation proceeding or a declaratory judgment, the right of jury trial is accorded to the parties, and most of the statutory rights, or all the statutory rights essentially contained in Chapter 109, are accorded to the putative father in that sort of situation. Section 5 allows the minor child through a guardian ad litem to file a paternity suit. Currently, there is a question whether the child is authorized to do so. And I say that because the bill, 109-125, currently states in Section 5 of the bill, page 2 of the A. Engrossed version, lines 30 and 31, the duly appointed and acting guardian of the child, conservator of his estate, or a guardian ad litem, if the guardian or conservator has the physical custody of the child and is providing support for the child. Line 35 contains the amendment, the minor child by a guardian ad litem. The Judiciary Committee of the Senate felt that that was an appropriate amendment. You may or may not feel that. The Justice Department did propose that bill just to make it absolutely clear that the minor child was, in fact, entitled to bring the paternity proceeding. Section 6 extends the statute of limitations for filing paternity proceedings from 6 years to 10 years. The 10-year period coincides with the 10-year limitation contained in the Statute of Ultimate Repose, ORS 12.140. Practically speaking, the older a paternity case gets, in other words, the older the child is, the more difficult it is for the state to establish paternity. And this is because, first of all, the obligor is entitled to a jury trial, and secondly, there has to be corroborating evidence. And as time goes on, it's difficult, sometimes difficult, to find that corroborating evidence. On the other hand, you often see a number of cases where it's very clear who the father is, and there's plenty of corroborating evidence, lots of letters by the putative father saying, yes, I am the father of the child, and the only reason the paternity can't be established is because of the statute of limitations at this point.
Question?
What was the original? Why did they have a 6-year statute of limitations originally?
I don't know. I assume that that was a product of the legislature.
Your view is always that because their cases could still be proven, there's enough evidence for you should be told the statute then for those cases.
That is correct.
Further questions?
No, I believe it would apply to children over the age of 6 right now.
So we pick up some.
You would pick up some additional.
Four years of the case.
further questions? Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 218? If not, let's take up Senate Bill 220.
There are three handouts I'm having, which Dennis is handing out at this point. I'll get to all three in my talk. Starting with the testimony on Senate Bill 220. This bill is a comprehensive revision of ORS Chapter 110, which is Oregon's version of the Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement and Support Act. Present Oregon law reflects the 1950 version of that act. The National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Law revised the 1950 version in 1968, but Oregon never adopted the 1968 revision. This bill proposes adoption of that 1968 revision. Various versions of the URESA Act, the Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement and Support Act, have been adopted in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and Guam. Reciprocity of support obligations and enforcement has also been established for the province of British Columbia. My office is currently conducting negotiations to establish reciprocity with Alberta, Manitoba, and West Germany. Since not all of you practice extensively in the domestic relations area, I prepared a question and answer sheet to explain or help explain how the Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement and Support Act is used. Basically, it is used to establish and enforce duties of child support when the children are located in one state or jurisdiction and the person required to support them is in another. It doesn't create any substantive duty to support. It is a procedural mechanism. I'd ask you to refer now to that information sheet that has been handed out. It's titled that. This has a couple of questions and answers. The first question is, what can a reciprocal proceeding filed under ORS Chapter 110 do for an Oregon resident? Well, when there are dependents living in Oregon, and a person responsible for their support lives in another state, a petition may be filed in an Oregon court asking the other state to first of all establish a support obligation in that other state which requires that person to help support the dependent. Secondly, you can ask the other state to enforce the support obligation so established. And third, in many states, paternity may be established if that has not already been done. And four, under this particular bill, the other state may be asked to register and enforce an Oregon support order, including the arrearages. Well, why file that sort of proceeding if there's, say, an Oregon divorce? The basic reason is that if the obligor is out of state in some other state, an Oregon court has really no way to enforce that Oregon divorce support order. And therefore, you've got to get a court order in the state where the particular person is located. It's a question of jurisdiction. Chapter 110, the reciprocal law, allows the other state or provides a mechanism for the other state to get jurisdiction. Who in Oregon may file a reciprocal proceeding? The person or persons for whom support is sought through either a private attorney, the district attorney, or the support enforcement division. Persons may also do their own filing without the services of an attorney. The other party that may file a reciprocal proceeding is the state or political subdivision thereof if either entity furnishes support to an obligee. In other words, if State of Oregon Department of Human Resources is furnishing child support or furnishing public assistance, then the state is entitled to bring a reciprocal proceeding to ask that another state order an obligor to pay child support. When Oregon acts as a responding state, in other words, the dependents live in the other state and the person responsible for support lives in Oregon, who does the legal work here in Oregon? And the answer is the district attorney does the legal work if public assistance is not being furnished to those dependents in that other state. But if public assistance is being furnished to those dependents, then the Support Enforcement Division will do the legal work. Question: how is the Support Enforcement Division doing with the public assistance related reciprocals? In other words, those reciprocals where support is either being given by another state or it's being given by the state of Oregon. The answer: in 1978, SED initiated 4,097 reciprocal proceedings in this state for transmission to other states. In public assistance cases, as a result of collections in other states, Oregon recovered $1,663,000 of public assistance. That's money that was sent to the state of Oregon and was used to offset the cost of public assistance. At the same time, the Support Enforcement Division here in Oregon collected and sent to other states a total of $975,000. So right now we're making a profit. There's several reasons why we're getting more from other states than we are sending out to other states. One of them is that Oregon is ahead of a number of other states in support enforcement. We simply file our petitions and let the other states do the legal work. They respond to the petition. A lot of other states aren't filing those reciprocal proceedings to the state of Oregon. So that's one reason for the imbalance. The other one is that Oregon is much more on top of its paperwork and it's got better accounting procedures, and so we're able to account for the money that has been received. The money that's being sent out will eventually, I imagine, come to equal the amount of money that is being received. That handout was designed to give you at least an idea of what a reciprocal proceeding is. One piece of terminology which you need to know when examining Senate Bill 220.
Can I ask a question about that? Why would we necessarily be... Doesn't that have to do more with population than with anything else about whether there are more people, supporters who are living outside of the state or more supporters who are inside the state? Wouldn't that just vary?
Well, if
isn't
you
that what we're talking about?
If you assume the number of dependents and the number of obligors is roughly similar, it should be a similar thing. I mean, we should send out as much as we get if everybody was doing an equal job. The difference is we're sending out a lot more reciprocal petitions than the other states are sending to Oregon. Since we're sending out that many more petitions, when the other states get those petitions, they enter a support order and we get the benefit of that support order. Now, when they start sending out their support petitions to Oregon in a volume more or less equal to what we're doing, then we will be, our collections will be picking up also, and it'll be much more even.
How much of a volume could we hit someday if all the other states started sending out the petition?
I would assume it would somewhat approximate the volume of filings that SED is doing right now, say roughly 4,000 a year. The reason I say that is if you assume that there's an equal number of obligors and obligees split between the states, the Support Enforcement Division is basically filing all our cases. We're filing as many reciprocals as there are to file. One of the limitations on filing a petition is you got to find the obligor first. And so as soon as we find the obligor, then we file a petition. And we're finding them at the rate of 4,000 a year, and that's what we're filing petitions at. Oregon also has a much more efficient locate unit than any other state, essentially. It's in the various surveys that they've conducted, the central locate unit of the Support Enforcement Division is number one in the nation in terms of finding people. It's finding basically 83% of the people they're looking for.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Okay. Returning to the testimony, the piece of terminology that you need to know is the words initiating and responding. If a lawsuit is started in the state of Oregon, Oregon would be called the initiating state because the lawsuit started here, and the state where the obligor is located would be the responding state because that state is responding to the paper sent from Oregon. The bill defines procedures and duties to be followed in Oregon when Oregon is acting as both as an initiating state and as a responding state. The 1968 ERISA Act does not create any duties of family support. The duties of support are contained in separate statutes in every state. This 1968 version is concerned solely with the enforcement of already existing duties of support. There are a number of small modifications to Oregon's 1950 version of the ERISA Act and several major changes to existing law and practice. A subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, composed of Senator Jim Gardner, Senator Cook, and Senator Wyers, held a number of lengthy hearings and examined each of these changes in detail. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved the subcommittee's work with no changes. The other handout I have given you is a short summary of what each section of the bill does to change existing law. It highlights what I consider to be the significant changes, and of course that's a subjective thought or subjective judgment call. But since I drafted the bill, I picked out what I thought were the significant changes. I have a question of the committee. How does the committee want to proceed? Do they want to go through the bill section by section, or do you want me to hit the very highest highlights?
Well, it's a pleasure to where are we going to get.
Really our last bill then, right?
Yeah.
Representative Smith?
Larry, I guess I'm more interested in the reason why we're doing this now rather than some other time. In general, I'd be inclined to support a modernization, if you will, of the Act. We already have the Act. Why have we waited so long and these are about to approve it?
I'm not certain. I know that nobody in the Support Enforcement Division had taken the time to look at the Uniform Act put out by the state commissioners and adopted to Oregon statutes. And the Support Enforcement Division simply had not done that, and so we didn't generate any legislation on that. I assume the district attorneys did not do that, probably because it takes a long time to sit down and look at the Uniform Act and compare it to Oregon statutes. And you have to have somebody that's familiar with what goes on in support enforcement. I think it was just simply a budgetary consideration.
Yes, Representative.
Can you generalize for us whether this will make it easier for Oregon dependents to collect under the Act?
Yes.
Is it easier for them as well as easier for you?
Yes.
What are the negatives?
I don't think there are any.
Kind of my impression. I'm not sure we have to go through it point by point is what I'm leading up to.
Yeah. Okay, I would then request that you highlight it for us and go through some you think the most important changes and then we'll see where we go with questions, if that's all right. Go ahead.
Okay. The first of the really significant changes would be in Section 5, the definitional section. And that is in the definition of a duty to pay support. The definition is changed to include the duty to pay arrearages. Currently, the statute just says you will have to pay support. It doesn't say anything about the arrearages. What happens is a number of other states do have the language saying you've got to pay the arrearages. So when we get a petition from another state, it asks for, say, $3,000 worth of arrearages on a support order in another state. It's a toss-up how the court in Oregon is going to handle that. Some courts just order current support. Other courts order current support plus arrearages. Right now, we're also laboring under the same problem. What happens when we send a case out of state on a reciprocal proceeding? Do you include the arrearages or not? Well, we're including the arrearages, and in some cases, we get back an order finding that there are the other state establishes the arrearages and is willing to support them, enforce them, and other times it doesn't. The statutory scheme, the latest scheme put out by the National Commissioners, is you will support or you will enforce arrearages, and so that change has been made. There's another change in the duty of support in that it adds that there is a duty to support a child between the ages of 18 and 21 if that child is attending school, and essentially if the other jurisdiction has a similar provision. In other words, if the other state didn't have a provision making people between the ages of 18 and 21 responsible for support, then that duty would not be enforced in the state of Oregon.
Okay.
What's that, Mason?
I realize it's not a unique provision, but has anybody examined that lately? And it seems to me that the move in the law has been towards emancipation at 18
That particular provision between the ages of 18 and 21 is not a provision that is contained in the Uniform Act. and in fact was not in the bill that I submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Assistant District Attorney Dale Kahn of the Multnomah County DA's office submitted that as a proposed amendment, and it was adopted by the Senate Judiciary Committee. That is why there's that unique disclaimer there. It includes the duty to pay support if the other jurisdiction has a similar duty.
Well, can you...
Yes, Mr. Mason.
Where are we talking about exactly?
In Section 5.
As defined in warrant 107-108.
The only look that I know that at any committee has really critically examined that statute is this committee when Mr. Kahn proposed some amendments on other support enforcement bills. Basically, I think he had a proposal that all children between the ages of 18 and 21 be supported if they were attending school. And the committee at that time indicated that they did not like that particular provision. What Mr. Kahn was doing was just merely proposing the law to be uniform across the board, because right now, if there is a child of a marriage, the parent can be made to support that child beyond the age of 18. But if that wasn't entered in the divorce decree and the child turns 18, then the child can't make the parent support. Or if the child is in fact illegitimate, or if the child was made legitimate pursuant to paternity proceeding, that child can't get support between the ages of 18 and 21. So there's an anomaly. The inconsistency in the law.
Can I ask, how long has that, is that just something that they did this session? No.
Which, the 107?
Yeah.
No, that's been around for a while. I don't know how long.
Yeah. Thank you.
I believe that the specific provision was probably enacted when the age of majority was changed from 21 to 18. Before that, a decree would provide that support would be until age 21 or otherwise emancipated, essentially.
Okay, why don't you go ahead then?
Okay.
The next significant version is contained in Section 12, so change contained in Section 16 of the bill on page 3, lines 23 through essentially 26. The present statute requires without exception that a petition that is filed in this state shall include the address of the dependent for whom support is sought. In other words, if the petition is being filed on behalf of a mother and children, the address of the children has to be stated in the petition. The amendment that is stuck in here in lines 25 and 26 states that upon a good showing of good cause to the court may order that the address of the person for whom support is sought be omitted from the petition. Sometimes, especially in cases of violence, child violence or violence to the spouse has gone to great lengths to conceal the address from the obligor, the person who owes the duty of support. And if they are required to include that, then, of course, the obligor is going to find out. And the argument cuts both ways. Because, on the other hand, sometimes the custodial parent has gone to great lengths to hide the children from the other parent, so the other parent won't be able to have visitation with the children. It cuts both ways. So this particular provision, 25 and 26, which is not in the Uniform Act, was put in by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Upon a showing of good cause or good reason to the court, the name would be omitted. And during the testimony and discussion that they had over there, they intended that that would mean if there was a danger of violence to either the children or to the spouse or former spouse, then that name would be omitted, but the court would not order that otherwise because of the very thing, visitation.
I've got some real problems.
I guess that is a good stroke, and I like it. We're just trying to interrelate that then, Larry, with Section 49, which relates to denial of visitation. I'm trying to see if they work together. Which one of them probably is from the Uniform Act, and one of them isn't.
Section 49 is Mr. Kahn again.
Oh, it is, okay.
and that is, in fact, a different version of the amendment that you have rejected twice already.
What is it? Have to give him one thing. He's got, you know, he's got to give him points for persistence. Anyway.
He came in with a shotgun approach.
Oh, yeah. Section 49 right now.
All right.
Just mark that one for deletion.
Yeah. Well, Section 49 is a little bit different than the ones that you faced previously. It is very limited and only applies to reciprocal enforcement and support proceedings. It's up to the state's decision whether or not they want to include or omit that particular section.
Get some more points.
I'm just breezing through some of the material I have to get the very high points. Most of these changes are either wording changes or they change it to conform to present practice. Unfortunately, the statute is not particularly closely followed in a number of instances. And one of those instances when it is not followed is when a petition is sent to the state of Oregon. The statute currently provides that the clerk shall file that petition and deliver a copy to somebody, the district attorney or court enforcement division. Clerks don't file them. The reason they don't file them is because very often the obligor is moved. The located information the other state had is not valid. The obligor is not in Medford. He's in Multnomah County. And so what they do is they take the petition and take it over to FED or DA. The DA looks at it, sees the guy is there, and then the DA has the clerk file. The changes in this bill bring that much more into conformity with existing practice. Existing practice is designed to streamline it, prevent a lot of excess filing in the courts, and still ensure that court obligations are enforced. Okay, the other really major change is involved in sections 43 through 46. That involves the registration of foreign support orders. Under current statutes, it's very difficult to file a support order or register, well, not very difficult, but there's a rather cumbersome process to register a support order in this state. You have to register it as a foreign judgment under ORS Chapter 24, 24010 to 24180. Now, those particular provisions have been deleted by the bill, whatever it is. House bill or a Senate bill, and another act is being substituted in at the request of the Oregon State Bar. I've not examined that act in particular detail. The only other Uniform Registration Act is contained in 24200 to 24255, and there's a specific provision in there that says it doesn't apply to support or matrimonial matters. So you, under that Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Recognition Act, you can't file a divorce order. You have to go into the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, and that involves filing a petition for registration, service of a petition, a 60-day waiting period, and then taking of a default, very roughly. The provisions in this bill are much more streamlined and essentially involve sending a copy of the three certified copies of the order to the other state, along with a statement of what your urges are and some other locating information. And it's registered. Then a notice is sent out to the obligor. The obligor has 20 days to come in and contest the judgment. And if the obligor does not do that, then it's final or confirmed order, and in fact, enforcement can take place. That's a lot more streamlined. It's a lot simpler procedure, and it was proposed by the national commissioners. There's essentially no variation over the Uniform Act, and it has been enacted in a number of states. The advantage of the procedure is it makes it very simple to send an Oregon support order to another state to have it registered. And of course, since you're picking up arrearages, you're going to pick up the arrearages that haven't been paid under, say, the Oregon divorce order in this state. And conversely, it makes it easier for the other state to register their support orders in this state. That's the really last significant change in the Act, other than Section 49.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Larry, is there any problem with deleting Section 47 from the bill in view of the fact that the big comprehensive civil procedure bill repealed 14.010? Does that do any damage to the rest of the bill?
because that would be repealed by this comprehensive civil procedure.
No, that doesn't do any damage to the bill. I guess there was one other change which I forgot, and that's the Cook Amendment. That was ORS 110.175, and that's why Section 47 appears in the bill, repealing the Cook Amendment. I should mention that Section 49 is a product of the compromise process that occurred in the Senate Judiciary Committee in repealing the Cook Amendment. The Cook Amendment basically said when a petition is filed in this state from another state, the obligee in that other state is submitting whatever support order exists in that other state, be it a divorce decree or whatever, to modification in this state. There are real problems with that. Senator Cook introduced it either 2 or 4 years ago. And it created all sorts of problems. For example, the Los Angeles District Attorney filed a case up to Oregon, and some attorney in Eastern Oregon read the law and modified the support order from $90 a month down to approximately $20 a month, just based upon testimony of the obligor. And that made the Los Angeles District Attorney rather mad, to say the least. So we wanted to get rid of that at all costs. And the cost was the inclusion
of
Section 49.
Good law.
I'm Eastern Oregon attorney,
yeah.
Well, we can put some amendments to apply to Cecil Cascade.
Right.
So that's why Section 49 is in there. Senator Cook agreed to the deletion of 110.175 if Section 49 was included. Because Section 49 is an attack on the visitation problem, and what he had, of course, intended was 110.175 would be one way of getting at the visitation problem when there's children in one state and the obligor is in the other state. There is a case that has been decided by the Court of Appeals on 110.175, upholding that statute, and that is on appeal to the Supreme Court right now. There's a petition for review pending, and also a petition for rehearing.
You mentioned your locate system. You also have a system, I don't know if that's what you mean by locate system. You also have a system, do you not, that indicates what the earnings of individuals are?
Yes, the department has access to the Oregon tax records to find out what those earnings are by quarter. And also what unemployment compensation is being given out of it.
Who has entered into that system?
Currently, the central locate unit of the Department of Justice and each branch office of the court.
No, I mean, what names? Who can you call up on that?
Basically, anybody who has withholding in the state. If you're withholding payments, your employer is withholding income tax payments, then basically you're on it. I don't believe I'm on it because I'm a state employee. People who are on the Railroad Retirement Act, railroad employees are not on that particular system.
Are state employees exempt from it?
I'm not really sure. I don't know. I can find out.
But basically, anybody who has withholding income in the state of Oregon is placed on that system.
Right. It's an employment division computer system or a revenue computer system.
To whom is that information available?
That is available in all SED branch offices. I'm not certain whether it's available in the Adult Family Service Division or not, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, the computer system. When employees are hired by, there are confidentiality requirements, but when employees are hired by SED, they do undergo a security check, and they are informed of confidentiality of that information.
So, in other words, if somebody working in a Portland office or the Klamath Falls office wants to know what Representative Lombard, Representative Mason worth earning, and Representative Cohen, for that matter, they can punch up a number and find that out.
Well, if their regular withholding is being conducted, and the catch is we'd have to know their social security number, because you can't call them up by name. We do know the social security number of obligors on our system, generally. So we generally can call up obligors earning.
Is that, and you say that system is set up because you share with the Department of Revenue the income tax information?
An agreement has been reached between the Revenue Department and the Justice Department for access to that information, yes.
Is that pursuant to a federal or a state law, or how does that work?
I'm not that familiar with it. I believe that federal law requires
that cooperative agreements be worked out to the extent possible, and I believe state law authorizes it, but I don't have an exact answer. I could research that question if you desire.
And what other than the confidentiality requirements, what other limitations are there on access to the system?
Well, they're in an office, an FCB office. There's a lot of people that can use terminals or FCB personnel.
How are the confidentiality requirements enforced?
Well, enforcement per se, the requirements are made known to every employee. I don't know of any proceeding where there actually has been an enforcement proceeding. I don't know of any abuses of the enforcement either. Why I don't know of any enforcement proceeding. I suppose no system is airtight like any other confidential information system, and perhaps abuses do occur. I don't see that that necessarily be prevented.
Do you have anything to
No, I
don't. Okay, is there anyone else testify on Senate Bill 220? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 220. We'll now move into work session. The first bill we'll take up in work session is Senate Bill 220. Are there motions regarding the bill?
I just wanted to counsel for the committee to fly inspect this bill. So we didn't have to fly inspect it ourselves. Or is Wally on the floor, so not do it on the floor?
No, I hadn't gone over it in any great detail. Other than to find that Section 47 is repealed by the Civil Procedure.
Chairman?
Yeah,
the question I guess I have is, you know, I remember carrying the bill on the floor to modify the foreign judgments law. So I would simply question how that meshes, if it does, if it's not, in Section 44 and 45, 46. And it seems to me that if we have provided for a simple procedure there that would be applicable here, and I think my recollection is we greatly simplified the registration procedure. We ought to have one uniform procedure, unless there's some compelling reason for having a different procedure. This does appear, glancing at it, to be a considerably different procedure, but maybe in substance, when you get down to comparing them item by item, not that different. I don't know. Have you checked out that bill at all?
No, I have not.
Well,
you can check.
I think we ought to, because if we get one administrative procedure, one procedure for non-support orders and one for support orders, rather than for all other orders, then I think we wouldn't be doing our folks any great benefit.
As I remember that bill which passed the House, there was a substantial reduction in the amount of time.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it was cut to
3 days. 3 days to 5 days.
In fact, it's a more liberal provision as far as being able to enforce a support order than this bill would provide.
And it didn't require personal service. As in a service of summons, it required mailing.
Mm-hmm.
And
given that this is a Senate bill, Mr. Chairman, I'd feel more comfortable if Council took a look at it before we passed
that. Well, it would be my intention that it is a rather long bill, and I missed part of the testimony. It would be my intention to take motions to amend it. And at that point, we would kind of sit back and let us do a day or two and have everybody fly spec it at their own convenience, and then perhaps move on it. I think we can dispose of the other four bills, though, today. Are there any motions regarding this bill? Representative Mason?
I don't know. I'd like to address the first thing about the idea of the child attending school. It's a pretty basic public policy thing, but I don't think that the child who's 18, because the child is attending Portland Community College or Vassar or wherever else may be, is foundation. Considering that if the parents are together and they can just say no, where apparently if they're apart, they can't. And I think that's bad public policy. I mean, that's a pretty basic public policy thing, but I think at 18, your parents want to support you, one parent wants to support you, fine. But I just would hate to see a situation about the only time someone's paying for someone to go to school is the fact they happen to be divorced. And not...
Representative Cohen and Representative Scott. We've had this, what happens with people who are currently eligible under this and they've been through the various petitions and all have sort of set that in place if we change this?
The 18th?
Yeah. And that's been...
I don't think that we eradicate that portion of the law that deals with the court extending to age 21 by dealing with it here. And if we are going to require support be paid for students to age 21, I think we should be consistent. Tom's raised an interesting issue. I wrestled with but never articulated quite so well, and I started to say that I frustrated a year ago by someone who came in and they put four kids through college, but the fifth one was still in the custody of the mother, the youngest, after the divorce, and suddenly the father was faced with putting the fifth one through school, although the agreement with the first four had been, you shall pay your own way through college. And so for the first four, the husband and wife living together had let the kids work their way through college, and now wife or ex-wife is sticking hubby for putting the fifth one through. Never worked out that way. Interesting.
As someone who put themselves through both college and law school with a very, very minimal amount of help from my parents, I don't think there's any constitutional right or even public policy reason that we should say that just because people have to be divorced that one spouse has the obligation of putting a spouse between the ages of 18 21 through school.
Okay, well, I guess I want to say right now I'm not willing to delete this section unless we go back and look at
the other one.
And I'm not sure that we want to get involved in that big of a... If we do that, I'd want a hearing on the whole thing with some sort of advertisement that that's really what we're doing, because I think that's a major change in the way the courts and attorneys and people who have expectations have been operating.
Well, I think that's a fair comment.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
The question is, are we going to extend what I believe is a bad law even farther? And I realize Representative Smith's point about consistency. Yes, there is a point of consistency, but we're being consistent, and I think in the sense that we're going to take something that I don't think is a bad law, and we're going to extend it even farther. That's why I would not opt for consistency in this situation. What I would really like to opt for is repealing 107-180. We're obviously not going to do that. It wouldn't be appropriate. It'd be mischievous. But I don't want to extend it any farther, and I'd like to take a shot at some other time.
Do you have a motion, Representative?
Yes, I would move that on page 1 of the bill that the language after the word, that's line 22, after the word unpaid, to be a period inserted, and that the language for the rest of line 22 and line 23 be deleted. I believe that will do it.
Okay. Representative Mason moves on page 1 of the bill, on line 22, after the word unpaid, a period be inserted, and the rest of that line plus line 23 be deleted. Is there discussion? Page 1 of the bill, line 22, after the word unpaid, insert a period, delete the rest of the line, and line 23. Is there discussion? Representative Smith.
Maybe Larry can help me. Larry, how many states observe laws similar to Oregon?
I have no idea.
Well, but you're asking us to come up with a uniform act. assume you're just suggesting that we just ask other states to enforce our law of 21. What that means then?
Chairman, yeah, that's my understanding of the way this would read. We're saying if in the other state they enforce the 21, we'll enforce the 21 here, and vice versa, if they do provide that first.
And if they are a state that enforces age 18, what do we look for when the decree comes to Oregon? We only enforce age 18.
We probably don't look. We probably
enforce it to age 21.
Well, no, we only enforce it to age 18 because the current law provides that you can have support for a minor. And there's nothing in the reciprocal statutes that authorizes you to award support between the ages of 18 and 21. What you're talking about here, what that motion is directed to, is a new provision that is not in existing law. We don't get support orders for children between the ages of 18 and 21 on reciprocal proceedings now. The only way you could do that is because kids turn 18 and reach the age of majority. The only way you could enforce such a duty now is registering a foreign support order that already contains such a duty.
So you're not receiving any support orders from other states for children aged 18 to 21, but you are processing out orders of support for children, Oregon children, who are between 18 and 21.
No, I don't think so. We merely ask for support, and generally the court in the other state will award for whatever their age of majority is. And I don't know of a specific case where there's been a conflict between what the age of majority is.
I see. The other state will not enforce it over 18?
I'm not aware of them enforcing it over the age of 18.
No matter what our law is? What happened to the full state and court?
Yeah.
Well, if you're registering a support order, then they will enforce it over the age of 18. They do not accord full faith and credit to a divorce decree that is entered in the state of Oregon when it's merely appended to a petition requesting that the other court enter an award of support. That's why you've got to register your decree. The court in the other state is not bound by the decree in this state. What they do is they get the obligor in front of the court, they examine the financial resources. Generally, they order the same as whatever the Oregon order is, but they sometimes order more and they sometimes order less.
So what you're saying is under the Uniform Act, we neither collect for 18 to 21 or enforce for 18 to 21.
Right.
So
present.
So this language is surplus.
It's a change from what current practice and current statute is, yes.
But if the other courts will not enforce from 18 to 21, then we have merely exposed our people to paying support between us.
We're not asking for support between the ages of 18 and 21. If we were asking, you've got to ask for it first in the petition. If you do ask for it, I don't know whether they'd enforce it or not. They might.
Do you have available to you, outside of this, the enrollment of the decree, foreign registration of the judgment decree in another
yes,
state?
Yes, we can ask district attorneys in other states to
And then
register.
For sure?
That does it, surely, because the decree becomes a decree of their state.
Well, then I'm not clear why you want this language.
This language was inserted at the request of the district, Multnomah County District Attorney.
Okay, the motion
it does. I might add, it does tend to make the law a little bit more uniform, depending on which way you want to go, because in a dissolution proceeding, support can be ordered between the ages of 18 and 21, so this would be an extension, as Representative Cohen pointed out. It's up to the committee to decide whether they want to make the law uniform that way, or if they want to make the law uniform that nobody over the age of 18 will get support.
But the problem with that is you tell me that the other jurisdictions won't enforce it between 18 and 21 in any event, so it doesn't matter what you write down here.
No, I don't know that they won't enforce it in any event. We're not asking for it, so they're not enforcing it. If we ask for it, I don't know whether they'd enforce it or not. When we send a petition to another state, we ask for what relief we want, and if the court has not requested to order support between the ages of 18 and 21, then the court doesn't order. You got to ask for it.
Okay. Any further questions?
I'd like to put that definition aside before I vote, Mr. Chairman.
What's the reason you've never tried to enforce the 18 to 21 support in other states? What were you sure about?
Because Oregon law, Oregon reciprocal law, doesn't define an added duty of support. And basically, the only place that you are authorized to get support between ages 18 and 21 is in a dissolution decree, and that's why we don't ask. If there is a dissolution decree that does provide support between the ages of 18 and 21, that's usually attached to the amendment or to the petition.
Oh, I see. You're talking about those cases in which support enforcement has brought the decree of support on the dissolution.
Right. I don't have
the and heretofore you have not had the authority, you think, to collect that support on it. Therefore you never asked for it.
Right.
Okay, so further discussion on the motion. The motion is by Representative Mason. On line 22 of the bill, after the word unpaid, to insert a period to delete the rest of that line and line 23. Okay. If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Richards?
No.
Mason?
Aye.
Cronberg?
No.
Cohen?
No.
Higgins?
No.
Gardner.
Aye. Fails. The further motions on the bill. The sheriff moved to delete section 49 of the bill. Is there discussion?
This is the part that Dennis thought we should delete, isn't it?
That's section 47. Mark
this
49.
This is 49. This is we have a law in the state that the people within the state can contest an obligation of support based upon a denial of visitation. This would change that for those people that had reciprocal decrees, where there might be a petition out of state coming in to be enforced.
Can you refer me to that section? I think you stated.
I don't have the statutory reference. Mr. Young probably would have it.
The visitation support statute is 107.431. And that says if there's an Oregon decree or order and visitation is being denied, you can move to modify or terminate support. But the specific language is if there's an Oregon decree or order. And since it's located in the dissolution statute, it's always been my contention that it does not apply to reciprocal orders. The specific language is at any time after a decree of annulment or dissolution of a marriage or a separation is granted. Sorry, not decree of order. Specifically tied to proceeding under Chapter 107. So right now, if you're being denied visitation, say you're under a reciprocal order to pay support in the state of Oregon and your children in the state of California, if you're being denied visitation with your children, you have no relief from that support obligation under currently existing Oregon statute. However, if your children are in the state of California and you were divorced in Oregon and you're not getting visitation and you're paying under the divorce decree, then you can move to reduce or terminate support based on 107.431.
Kind of another question.
Let's say
on line 38, it says that a denial shall not affect the determination. Does that mean that you cannot change the duty of support because of a denial, or does that mean that you can change the duty of support irrespective of the denial?
I'd say that would have to be read in conjunction with 107.431, which says, essentially, that the defense of lack of visitation is not available in a reciprocal proceeding. This modifies that in that it says, if there is no Oregon or decree or support order, then whether or not there's visitation is irrelevant. I agree it's susceptible to reading both ways, but I think
it does say closer.
On closer examination, I think you have to refer to 107.431.
Maybe we ought to write it, if we keep it, so that upon reading you can understand it.
Well, your contention is that this is really surplusage because it doesn't really affect the current state of the law is that 107.431 does not apply to these situations, and that that's the present law. That's accurate.
That's my contention, yeah.
Okay, so your contention would be that Section 49 is not needed.
Right. Mr. Kahn contends that regardless of whatever the law is, when a circuit judge has a reciprocal proceeding in front of him, and a denial of visitation is claimed, the judge is sometimes not entering an order of support based on 107.431. I think the judge would be misreading the law in that sort of situation.
And I come at it kind of a different point, because I think that there are occasions in which a person might be in the state and still be being denied visitation and should have the same rights and obligations as other Oregon residents have, but perhaps have an Oregon decree. Is there further discussion on the motion?
A general comment relating to all of it in committee meetings, relating back to Kip's original discussion having to do with making this uniform with the Procedures Act, and that is, if we replace that procedure with Kip's procedure, or if we consider removing this, I think it's helpful in the Uniform Act to have the complete recipe in one place. And so if there is a potential for misinterpretation by the judge under a reciprocal, it seems to me it's worthy of having in here if it serves a good policy, and it ought to all be in one chapter under one unit. And I'd hate to take it out just because you think it's somewhere else. If it clarifies the situation, then I think it ought to be all in one place.
Well, perhaps to narrow the policy consideration, we should be proposing language in the alternative to this to allow for modification of support or termination where there shouldn't be a denial of visitation on the part of those people that are residents of this state but who have a decree that's asking to be enforced from outside the state. Because I think probably in 90% of the cases it would go the other way. But I can see situations where someone could be denied visitation in this state. And just because you have an Oregon decree and it works the other way, Mr. Young has said, if the divorce is in Oregon and the custodial parent is in California and the decree is decided in Oregon, then that person can move to modify on the basis of denial of visitation. So it seems like there's really a denial of protection on, in some cases, some party's point.
Mr. Chairman, there is a way to weasel around that if you wanted to. If you have an Oregon decree and the children are in California and they're being denied visitation, and the obligor moves to modify or terminate support, the support is modified or terminated, what happens is the kids down in California will file a petition under the Reciprocal Act. They'll come up to Oregon. Oregon has to hear the petition, and an order of support will be entered. And then the lack of visitation is not a defense to the order of support.
So,
you're getting kind of convoluted if you start having to play games like that with support orders. Generally, it would work. Generally, frankly, the reciprocal petition would just be say, well, there's a divorce petition. We're not going to have two orders in this state. And they consolidate the cases.
I guess what I need to do basically is to develop some language to present to the committee to make it clear that even in that case, if there's a denial, if there can be a showing of a denial of support or denial of visitation, that the obligation of support terminates.
I need to speak to that for just 1 minute. That's going to be practically so in practically every case where the children are out of state, because the obligor is going to come in and say, the children have been moved to another state, I cannot afford to visit them or have them sent to me, my visitation is being denied, and therefore I want my support order terminated. They got a prima facie case of denial of visitation based upon that sort of circumstance, and you lose sight of that. The goal is you want to support those kids, too. Just because they've moved doesn't mean the parent shouldn't have to support those children.
Okay. I don't know where you get that denial of visitation, but I don't think that walks on and busy for it. And, you know, the distance is a weak reason. It's not going to make it. Denial has to be denial, and the distance business would be a substitute, a part of a obligor.
But the distance cuts both ways. If the obligor walks into the Oregon court and says she's denying visitation because the children are in Virginia, then she's got to show cause in Oregon why that she is or is not denying visitation, and that's a tough job. Does she have to come to Oregon at that point? Because generally, it's the father against the mother.
Well, it's interesting. We have a law that works for people within this state. You know, it's the law in this state basically is that there's a denial of visitation, there can be a termination or modification of support based upon that. Okay, and really, you're setting up two classes of citizens. You're setting up a group of people who happen to be separated by distance, and one of them is not in this state, and you're putting them in an entirely different position than people that are within this state. And I don't think that's right. I don't think that's consistent either. And if the law is such for Oregon residents, or two people who are in Oregon, there can be, and it's possible, that there can be a situation where there can be a denial of visitation on the part of people that happen to be in other places.
It depends on which factors you focus on. If you focus purely on the denial of visitation, then it would appear that you should have some sort of mechanism that allows you to modify or terminate the order based upon lack of visitation. But there are other factors involved, and one of them is distance, and it's, you know, we're saying you're creating a different class of people, and that's true, but one of the reasons there's a different class of people is because of the fact of the situation, the fact of distance.
Would you deny the fact that there could be just as strong a denial of visitation where people are separated, say, by 2,000 miles as opposed to 2 miles?
Oh, sure.
You can't argue that.
No, you can't argue that. The question is, how are you going to litigate it? Are you going to require the other parent to come in and defend?
Well, perhaps we need some safeguards to protect the state so that it, you know, it's certain to get its money if, in fact, there's not a showing or a proper showing. But it seems to me that there should be a mechanism available for those people as well as for people within the state. It bothers me greatly.
The thing that bothers me about a whole series of your bills is, you know, and that is that certain defenses have heretofore been available to the obligor. And throughout this whole series of bills, I see you and the district attorney chipping away, whether it be the statute of limitations. You told us earlier on the statute of limitations, some people are winning on the statute of limitations. Therefore, we'd like to change the statute of limitations. Every plaintiff's attorney in this whole state would love to change the statute of limitations because we've all got good cases, but statute of limitations is there for a purpose other than that. And the same thing here. A father may have a legitimate defense that you're saying, well, it was a few of these people are winning on it, we'd like to change this defense. And it's really the change the goalpost philosophy, and you're doing a good job of it, I'll have to admit. Time you get through, the obligor is going to be lucky if he leaves with his shirt.
Mr. Chairman, you have a reply?
Mr. Young is going to
represent. A witness gets a reply from Mr. Young.
I point of personal privilege for the witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2 points. On the statute of limitations, the committee has to look at who they're protecting. Are they protecting the accident victim or the child who's been denied paternity? That's clearly a policy decision for the committee to make. Speaking to the bill and the issue of support versus visitation, frankly, this is not an issue that the state is particularly concerned about, because the state can always file suit to reimburse itself for welfare that has been extended. You're talking about being able to modify a support order based upon lack of visitation. The people you're really talking about are the people who are not on public assistance. Now, the state can always turn around and file a support for reimbursement of public assistance. the obligee and the obligor are not in that sort of situation. They're sitting out there on their bare child support rights. If a motion for modification or termination is filed in Oregon, and the children are in, say, Virginia, if the state is giving public assistance, the state's going to get it. It's money, more than likely. But if the kids aren't getting public assistance in Virginia, the kids are just sitting there with their mother or their father, whichever it is, in effect, you're going to require that mother or father to come to the state of Oregon to litigate the issue at a tremendous expense. And the problem is, generally, the child support money is essential for survival. And the whole reason that they're concerned about the child support in the first place is because they got to have it to live, and to waste the money by, well, not waste the money, but to have to expend a large amount of money to come and litigate that sort of issue is defeating the purpose.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman,
I'm Representative Cohen.
Now, I want to follow that up now and say, by deleting Section 49, what are we doing? How are we affecting the process you just laid out for us?
If we're not affecting it whatsoever.
I hear the chairman's response.
His position is that Section 49 is not needed, it's surplus.
Okay, thank you.
Over the question. Is there further discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none.
Stop. Further motions regarding the bill?
Well, I think, Chairman.
Appeal 48, too.
Yeah, I think that Dennis said the 47 should be deleted as well.
Yeah, but now I'm interested as well in Section 48. Do you want to leave ORS 110.175 on the books, or do you want to repeal it and replace it with nothing? I should perhaps read 110.175.
475? Or 175, yeah.
That's what Mr. Young referred to as the Cook Amendment. And it says, when a petitioner who is an obligee, as defined in ORS 23.760, seeks relief in this state under this chapter, he submits to the jurisdiction of the responding court in this state as to the responding court's power to set aside, alter, or modify any provision for the payment of future support in the order, decree, or judgment which impose the duty of support upon the obligor. Now, the situation you described was the one in Eastern Oregon, is that right? Okay. The bill with Section 48 in it literally repeals ORS 110.175 that I just read.
Which then would not allow for any kind of modification.
All right. Mr. Chairman?
Representative,
I would move to delete that portion of line 30 that appears after the word repealed.
Okay. Representative Rutherford moves on page 7 of the bill, line 30, that after the word repealed, a period be inserted in the rest of the sentence be deleted. Discussion?
The reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is I think that Mr. Young testified that they had a lot of trouble under that provision of the law, and I think that it is unfair when someone seeks to enforce their support decree to expose them to that kind of result where they are not even present and have an opportunity to be heard. And the court hears only one side of the case.
Okay.
Dennis? You were over on the Senate side. What will be the reaction, in your opinion, of the Senate when they see that the provision that they used as a replacement is gone and all that's left is the repealer?
Well, I can't predict that. Senator Cook, you know, there's obviously a trade-off here. Get rid of 110.175 and have Section 49 of the bill. I think Mr. Conn and I convinced him that 110.175 is not a particularly good section, but I'm not certain of that. It could be that we merely convinced him it was not good as long as you're going to have Section 49. I can't predict it.
Well, Section 49 does have anything to do with 110.175.
Oh, yes, it does.
Can you explain that?
Okay. Maybe that wasn't made clear. Under subsection 1 of section 49, it says when there is an Oregon decree of annulment or dissolution, and a court is acting as a responding court, and the child lives in a state which has not enacted the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, then... Okay, I'm wrong.
Doesn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Right. I now remember thinking that in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It
Senator,
really does.
Senator Cook traded away his amendment for absolutely no, for something that had absolutely nothing to do with it or affected it.
Well, Chairman, I feel an obligation to tell Multnomah County legislator, to Senator Cook, to protect him, protect his interests, and make sure that if this 48 is not Section 48 itself is not deleted, that he knows what happened and he'll know.
He may or may not.
But we case maybe, so that the appropriate action can be taken, because I think Senator Cook thought
what are you talking about, appropriate action?
Excuse me? That's not appropriate action, non-concurrent.
Yeah. Okay. You know what the motion is. The motion is on line 30, after the word repealed, insert a period, delete the rest of the sentence. Is there further discussion? Is there objection?
Yes.
If not, the clerk, well, if there is, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Justice?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Nathan?
No.
Lumber?
Aye.
Peter?
Cohen?
Aye.
Aye. Passes.
Now, section 47.
Okay. Okay, Representative Rutherford moves that section 47 bill be deleted. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
I'm
reading.
This is the part
that
was covered by the...
It's repealed by the civil procedure bill.
Right.
All right, but that relates back to my question. Are we going to put some kind of cross-reference in here so that the entire recipe is in one place? Or does the judge have to know the law in this area is somewhere else and refer to that? Should there not at least be a cross-reference here?
Well,
jurisdiction is in the rules of civil procedure.
Yeah.
The judge will have to know those.
Jurisdiction equally appears in one place. Jurisdictional statute.
Well,
carry through with your idea. We would have to put a cross-reference in place of every statutory section which was repealed and replaced by the rule, which I don't think was the intention of the draft. There are going to be numerous sections of the statute that will be gone, replaced by the rule.
And the intention was to put everything all in one place. Bring all these sections in.
Call for the question. Okay. Is there further discussion on the motion? Motion by Representative Rutherford to delete section 47. Is there objection? Hearing none, stop. Then we get to sections 44, 45, 46. Those are covered. We're working on your bill, Mr.
Young. Yeah. Well, I would have a request to the committee on dealing with sections 44, 45, and 46. Some sort of language be put in the bill. I'm not at all certain that provision that was passed by the House, changing Chapter 24, is going to pass the Senate. If some sort of language could be put in that perhaps these sections are enacted unless that other bill passes, that would be good. I would hesitate to say it. I'm willing to trade them off at this point because I haven't examined.
Why don't we hold that statute?
Okay. Are there any further motions on the bill? You had a question about the address. Sure. Address?
The bill met upon a good showing the address of where the mother and children are for safety reasons.
Page 3, lines 25 and 26.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose I have the concerns Representative Smith has about the problem where there's violence, but I also have concerns about someone who runs off to another state with the kids and then basically is hiding out and is able to use the power of the courts of that state to enforce some kind of duty of support and never make themselves known. That's also a concern. I think that's a possibility.
Right, I agree that is, but that's why the word good cause, you got to show good cause to the court why the address shouldn't be included, and I I'm the intent. There's good cause is a term of art under federal regulations, which involves basically there has to be a substantiated threat of violence to either the children or the obligee.
We're not federal court. Mm-hmm. But Larry's right, Nancy. I remember that much from my years in Department of Human Research. That good cause is like a euphemism. It means that the husband has threatened violence, and there's an ever-growing body of federal rules and laws that I believe are known to most practitioners in the welfare area. I don't know if it's that they're known to all the domestic relations judges, but because the husband threatened to beat up the wife, and that's the reason we're going to hide her, and she won't have to come forward and give her its address.
Mr. Chairman?
Ever since then?
Then, to side with the chairman for a moment, though, in the domestic relations practice, you can't go in to a judge ex parte right now and with an affidavit. Basically, that's sufficient cause to get a restraining order. That would result possibly in a show cause hearing within a limited amount of time. And I don't think it takes very much to get a restraining order, and this, I think, is probably comparable to obtaining a restraining order. If there's any doubt in the judge's mind, they haven't got time to believe the thing. They're just going to grant it and say, okay, you don't have to put the name and address in.
You know,
it'd be an easy thing to get.
There's one other thing here. We've been talking about differences as far as people's circumstances are concerned. You don't get a reciprocal support unless the custodial parent, in this case, if she was in this state, and there's good cause shown in this state, then the obligor has to be out of state. So the imminence or threat of violence is rather remote. The guy's got to catch a plane and come back and do something as opposed to walking down the block and hitting her over the head.
It does happen.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Young, would you recommend that we delete the address requirement from the divorce petition?
From divorce petition?
No, there is no written address requirement in divorce petition. You've got to have jurisdiction venue. There's a venue requirement in divorce petition, but there's no address requirement.
So, not only there, Tom, but also in the required language, at least that we're requiring the Multnomah County rule to follow, in the decree, when there is a DHR order, your abstract has to show and also requires 10-day notification of the current address to the Department of Human Resources. Now, I don't know, the DHR then is prohibited from giving out that address if the obligee or the obligor calls in and says, what's the current address of the other party? But that information is required now by DHR regulation. So
I'm not sure. Does DHR release the address on an ongoing assistance case?
No.
This is Mr. George Keith from the Army Human Resources and Support Service.
Those are confidential. But the source of that material usually comes from the parties who have filed the decree and the abstract, who at that time have to give employment information and address information, and the decrees are required to state that either party shall give 10 days notice of a change of address. I'm wondering if that... isn't enough to expose publicly what the address is already anyhow. I guess to get the DHR there and
getting
it out.
It's been my experience dealing with a number of circuit court clerks throughout the state. When they used to maintain, and those that still do, maintain their court records, they don't release the address. And oftentimes they have a set of duplicate books. If you want to go in and examine the payment record, they have a public set and a private set if they're not computerized. The private set contains the address. The public set doesn't. But again, that's like any other provision that you have for any confidentiality. Abuses are bound to occur at some point.
Is there a motion?
I'll move deletion of the language on page 3, line 25, starting with however, and going to the down to line 26, and ending the petition.
Okay, Representative Mason's moved on page 3 of the bill, lines 25. Deletion of the sentence beginning with the word however and continuing on line 26 and ending with the word petition. Discussion.
Well, I just say that I would oppose that because I think there is an overriding concern to allow in exceptional cases that the address not be given out to avoid violence.
I agree. Further discussion, Mr. Smith?
I still think I agree, but what this all started from was, I think, Dennis's statement that welfare attorneys understand what good cause is, but it's very clear to me that a domestic relations attorney, I don't know what it means, and if I don't, I've got a good hunch that domestic relations judges don't know. What we need is definition in that sentence. I think the policy is valid, but we need to refine it.
Okay, I'm basically at the same point that you're at, represents.
I'll withdraw my motion if somebody wants to present alternative language.
Dennis, can you make a note to...
Yeah, work on that with something that reflect the threat of imminent physical...
Yeah, that's one, aren't they? Yeah, threat of violence.
The affidavits of domestic relations aren't put out with Steve, by Stephen Ness yet, saying he threatened me before, but it's closed.
Yeah. Okay, is there any further motions on the bill? Okay, if not, we'll let this one sit, and we'll show up again on the work session again with the full committee. I think we can probably dispose of the other bills. They're fairly simple. Let's take up Senate Bill 210.
On 210, page 3, section 6, there was the issue I raised about the CIC getting a windfall. And Larry says it's controlled by federal regulations anyway, and then Larry and I agreed that we might try to work on some language to put in the bill.
Okay, we'll hold that over then.
I'd have an amendment to the bill.
Representative Lester?
I would move that the bill be amended to provide that the prevailing party would recover attorney fees.
Okay, Representative Rutherford moves a conceptual amendment to the bill to allow the prevailing party to recover attorney's fees.
What section of the bill is that now?
That would be in section 4 of the bill, where it presently provides that only the obligee can receive fees if the obligee prevails. Representative Lombard?
Okay, from a budgetary standpoint, then, you've got the district attorney bringing the action and it loses, and do we provide in here that the county shall pay? You know, that should be an obligation upon the county to pay, taking out of the DA's pocket.
$25 a case that they use.
And likewise, from the state of Oregon standpoint, who do we provide pay that if SED
loses?
Come out of the Department of Justice's budget or DHR's budget? They're pointing at each other, you say.
We end up with their bill, yeah.
They would come out of court enforcement, I would think. They would pay their... an attorney doesn't pay the attorney's fees.
Okay. As I understand your motion, if the party was bringing the action with the district attorney, the county would pay, and if the party bringing the action was the court enforcement division, the attorney general would pay.
Court enforcement would pay.
All right. Okay.
Make them read their cases when we're both at home.
For further discussion of the motion, is there objection to the motion?
Larry looks like he has to say something. Confidence a bit.
There's another problem in line 37. It says shall include upon motion. There's no discretion given to a judge. You want to make it discretionary?
Line 31?
Line 37, it says essentially any decree entered for enforcement shall include if the obligee prevailed on the motion.
Your position is softening, I noticed.
was this your shell?
Yeah. It was their shell.
It was their shell.
It's funny how their standard changes. There further discussion on the motion. Did you want to say anything further?
Well,
I think the court's about to rule.
Frankly, if I could, I don't know if the committee would grant this to me. I'd like to go back and talk to the people in the Department of Justice to see what they think.
Well,
they're going to start being nicked for attorney's fees.
Well, the Department of Justice.
Oh, it's the Department of Justice.
Support services. Well, I'm sure they're going to want to say something, too.
Okay. This bill is not coming out today because there has to be some language in the last section. So I think that this committee can always reconsider the positions it takes. Whether it would reconsider is another matter. So further discussion on the motion?
Okay. Call the roll.
Clerk will call the roll.
On which motion?
The motion is by Representative Rutherford to provide for attorney's fees to the prevailing party.
Mandatory attorney's fees? I
think that that's the shall that is there continues.
Is that correct?
That's the way the law reads. Yeah, somebody has another motion,
then. If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lauber?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
Rutherford? Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Digger?
Aye.
Cohen?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Passes. That's my vote for my attorney friend.
Okay.
Not the vote for your attorney friend. Now, listen, I want to get one thing clear. The attorney, the person that pays the fee is the client. And we're talking about some guy who's trying to scrape bucks together. By definition, or he'd be paying his child support. And the state brings an action against him. And the state loses, and now he's out of pocket. That's who we're talking about. So don't think that the attorney just got a ball. It was just for the guy that is getting sacked.
Okay, the bill will be held over for language to be presented to the committee by council in Section 7 of the bill. Take up House Bill 211, Senate Bill 211.
Section 1 would be deleted because it was inadvertently inserted.
Okay, the chair moved deletion of Section 1. Is there discussion?
Would that automatically renumber it?
Yeah. Is there objection? Hearing none, so. Is there any other issues raised with this bill?
Chairman?
Since
then.
Wait, Chairman, page 2, lines 4 and 5 provides that the party submitting the original order for signature shall submit an extra copy for forwarding by the clerk and shall indicate on the copy where it's to be forwarded. That would cut down whatever expense there is to the county to a postage stamp and labor.
Yeah. I think it's probably pretty minimal. Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
Move forward to pass.
Representative Auburn moves Senate Bill 211 as amended to forward to do pass recommendations. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative? Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Lumber?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Peter?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Senate Bill 218.
I think in this one you might want a conflict amendment if you think there's any possibility that the rule of civil procedure wouldn't pass.
Perish the supply.
That would pick up Section 2 and Section 7.
Which portion has is the statute?
Section 2. You're on 218, right?
Mm-hmm.
218, Section 2 of the bill would be repealed by the rules of civil procedure.
Okay, so we were in a position of deleting Section 2.
Yeah, you either delete it and just trust that these things would get through, because these pick up the same language. You want the language in Section 2.
Okay.
If the rules go down, you still want the language in Section 2, presumably, because you put it into the rules.
I don't think the rules are fair.
Well,
you?
No, I don't think they're fair.
You're
yeah. Possible.
I know, but we're on that.
I would move that in Section 7 of the bill that we delete the language in Section 7 and insert an amendment saying that these rules would take effect only if do we have a bill number?
Only if
the bill number for the rules of civil procedure, if that bill fails, does not become law. Is there discussion?
No.
Excuse me?
I'm trying to reconcile what you're deleting, first of all.
Okay, I'm taking out Section 7.
Right, and I'm wondering...
And I'm saying that we're just turning it around. We're just saying that this will not become law unless the rules of civil procedure fail. Then it would become law. It shall only have effect if the rules of civil procedure fail. Section 2.
I'm not having trouble with what you're putting in. I just want to know what paragraph E of sub 1 of ORS 14.035, which was giving effect, regardless of the passage of the ordinance, we're deleting that language. I don't know what.
Well, that's Section 2 of the bill.
That is Section 2.
If you look at Section 2, it's ORS 14.035 is amended to read.
I got you. Okay.
Okay.
Fine.
And 1E is the operative effect of the change.
Mr. Chairman, the problem with your amendment is it's going to happen regardless of whether your amendment passes or not. If the rules of civil procedure are not passed, then ORS 14.035 will still remain. If they are passed, then 14.035 will be repealed. You don't need to put in new language if you want to accomplish your effect. You just simply delete Section 7.
Well, what would happen if these rules pass first and then still pass second? I believe the rule is that the latter prevails, then 14.035 would be revised, I believe. In any case, it's a legislative council type of amendment, and I can go down there and have them fix it up.
Okay. Motions by the chair to change Section 7 to provide Section 2 of the bill will only take effect if the rules of civil procedure fail. Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Chair would then move that Senate Bill 218 as amended be sent to the floor to do pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I had another amendment.
Chair, with thoughts?
I would amend move that Section 6 of the bill be deleted.
After 6 to 10 years, that's the limitation.
Okay. Where's that at?
Page 3.
Line 25.
Right above Section 7 on the bottom.
Okay. Okay. Representative Mason moves that Section 6 of the bill be deleted. Is there discussion?
Same thing, isn't it? Isn't that, we could share that in.
Section.
Yeah.
I guess that would leave the old law in effect.
That's
leave
the old law.
Yeah.
Is there discussion?
Representative Mason? Well, I made my speech earlier. I think it's changing the goalposts. And if the only reason to change the statute of limitations is that you've been losing cases because of the statute, that's a precedent we want to set. We better get some extra chairs in this room. Because everybody who gets burned by a statute of limitations would love to have the statute repealed.
Of course, we've made the policy decision in some areas of law that there is no statute of limitations, such as in case of murder. Now, I'm not saying this is akin to murder, but...
Quite the opposite.
State losing money is
it's
very important event.
Well, in your statutes of breeding life.
And apparently there aren't that many cases that are broad.
Anything further, Representative Mason?
My life for 10 years.
Okay, the motion is by Representative Mason to delete Section 6 of the bill. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
No.
Rester?
No.
Mason?
Yes.
Lombard?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Aye.
No, it fails. Is there a motion on the bill is amended? Representative Smith moves Senate Bill 218 as amended before with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Need to be reprinted?
I think that's okay. Okay, if there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Nope.
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Peter?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye, passes.
Your report, Tom?
Is there further business to come before the committee? I want to thank the committee for its patience, and for everybody showing up reasonably on time.
Larry?
It's time to return.
Really, good question.